I'm glad that you presented it as Bran lost the arm and not Bran lost a shield. And the arm attached to it. Live from the Mundangerous Extra Life charity campaign in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 19 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about one of the most common storytelling frameworks, the 3-act structure. But first, the Morning Glory campaign breaks a cardinal rule of high fantasy, and our strength-based monk punches above its weight class in the Character Creation Forge.
But before all that, you want to talk about the recent panel with Chris Perkins that made the rounds on the internet in the last couple weeks.
Actually, even before that, I want to announce that we're doing a mailbag episode for the end of the year. We respond to all of our listener mail, but if you have a question you'd like answered on the air for that episode, email it to us at totalpartythrill@gmail.com before December 17th.
Okay, shameless plug out of the way. Should we talk about Chris Perkins?
Yeah, so Chris Perkins, I'm sure most of you know, but he's a game designer at Wizards of the Coast who's been working there basically forever, since essentially the TSR days. And he spoke at a panel at, I'm not making this up, GameHole Con 2015.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's a great con, but maybe they might want to work on that name.
Branding. Anyway, so he has a lot to talk about in terms of the thinking of the Wizards team and the way that they're rolling out 5th edition products, which I found really interesting, considering a lot of the complaints that fans have had and the things that we've talked about here on the podcast about concerns we potentially have about the future of the hobby. So, for example, he says the reason that we're not getting a lot of product, right? There's an Unearthed Arcana every month, but other than that, we've only really gotten one splat book, right? Mm-hmm. Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide.
Yep.
The reason for that is that they're taking what he calls a Blizzard approach, which is releasing fewer products, but making them very big, very good, high quality, and something that almost everyone in the hobby can actually use. So what he actually said was, we don't sell products so that 5% of our audience can use 5% of it. We're now trying to sell products that 100% of our audience might use, and they'll use all of it. That sounds like a good idea. It's interesting that they then chose to release a Forgotten Realms book, but I think we did a pretty good job of showing you can use that in any kind of D&D.
Yeah, I mean, the skeptic in me says...
You're all skeptic. There's no skeptic in you.
That's true. But, okay, so let's talk about Sword Coast Legends, the video game.
Do we have to?
They've spent hyping, right? Because that's certainly not high quality. The reviews on it have been terrible. It's taken up a ton of time, and it's not being played by many people. So who's benefiting from that?
I mean, it seems like it's something that only 5% of the hobby is using, so why are they investing so much into it?
Right.
Also, he talks about how the Wizards team is really small now, or it's around 15 people, when in the past it used to be 50.
Yeah, that's an interesting count, too, because previously, actually, as of last Christmas, after their holiday job cuts, Wizards of the Coast had 4 people on the D&D team, so I'm curious how he's counting 15. I'm guessing that's a lot of digital people.
Yeah, or maybe even freelancers.
Well, I know they're outsourcing all the modules, right? I mean, we know Green Ronin wrote the Adventurer's Guide. We know that Sasquatch Games wrote one of the Adventure Paths. So they're not even doing that in-house anymore. It's very confusing to me.
I agree. One thing I do find a bit heartening, though, is he says they're focusing on these properties that they already have that have a lot of name recognition. And we've talked about this before. It really feels like 5e is sort of a greatest hits of D&D. They're bringing back all the old stuff that everyone loved before and just updating it so it's more usable, it's maybe a little more balanced, which is why he said their first story was Tyranny of Dragons, just sort of basing that around Tiamat, who is, you know, very recognizable with people who play Forgotten Realms, people who played Dragonlance. And of course, you know, it focused on dragons, which is just something really iconic about the hobby.
Right. And then you've also got awesome minis that come out of that too, right? Who doesn't want a 5-headed dragon mini?
Right. Although he did say apparently that's a problem with the video game because Tiamat was just really big and it's hard to see on your screen. So they actually don't like focusing on large enemies, which just seems silly. Like he was talking about doing against the giants, which is great. It's got a lot of name recognition. It's got a lot of history, but those giants are just too big for the screen. So I guess we're not really going to do that.
If you can't tell, we're not big fans of Sword Coast Legends.
Yeah. But he did say then that's the reason they did the second story as Elemental Evil. Right? It's sort of an update of the old Greyhawk classic, and then they move into Rage of Demons, which is taking place in the Underdark. They're hitting up all of the common touchstones and set pieces.
Yeah, I think moving away from sort of what they're doing right now, another really interesting part of it, he talked a little bit about survey results and the numbers that Wizards of the Coast has in terms of what games are actually being played.
Right. It turns out, at least according to their surveys, which we can argue about methodology, but it said 55% of all of you play homebrew. But half of those people use material that has been officially released to create your homebrew settings, which I think is exactly what most homebrewers do.
Right, right. But for me, what stood out was how large of a chunk Forgotten Realms was.
35%.
That seems insane. But, you know, maybe that's just my own sort of bias against Forgotten Realms coming out that I'm surprised that a third of all games are played in Forgotten Realms.
Well, you made a point about, you know, what counts as a game being played in Forgotten Realms. You know, like if you're playing the adventure path that just happens to take place there but doesn't really have anything to do or doesn't need to be in the Forgotten Realms and has no history there, what did you write in your survey? Like, yes, I'm playing Forgotten Realms.
Right, yeah. You've only sold me Forgotten Realms.
Right.
I guess I'm playing Forgotten Realms. It runs into that problem. And the same thing for us too, right? Was our Eberron campaign homebrew? We had a lot of homebrew in it.
Right, but there's no official 5e Eberron material. And so it all depends how was that question asked in the survey. Yep. If it said, hey, are you using homebrew material? I would say, of course I am. Yeah. Are you running Eberron? Yes. Both of those things are true.
Are true.
I don't know if they count that as mutually exclusive.
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't part of the survey, but I'm very curious as to how they got those results. So I'd love to hear from our listeners. I think most of the email we get is about homebrew or Eberron. Frankly, you know, a lot of people are excited to be running Eberron and, you know, want to hear about that, but it would be.
As they should be.
Because of Morning Glory, of course we have Eberron listeners and we love Eberron listeners. But, you know, I'm curious and how you guys, Eberron players, feel. How would you describe that? You know, as a GM, have you changed enough that you no longer feel you're necessarily running in Eberron? You're just using Eberron or... How would you answer that question on a survey? I'm curious. If you want to tweet at us, at Mundangerous, M-U-N Dangerous.
Or at TPTcast.
Yeah, I guess you can tweet at the whole show.
Perkins also did say that future adventures aren't going to be relegated to the Forgotten Realms. They actually might take place in more than one campaign setting at a time. So, I don't know. Does that mean Planescape? Are we going to see the return of the City of Doors? Spelljammer, I think probably not, but at least there will be ways that will make planar travel more accessible.
I mean, yeah, let's see it. So the final thing I want to mention that was in this interview was a call to action, which is that they're looking for feedback on the Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide, right?
Yeah, I mean, he said specifically they don't know if Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide is going to succeed for them, if it's really going to work out, or if the fan base is going to like it, but they're definitely paying attention to the feedback that they're getting. So if you like it, let them know and then tell them, hey, we would really like an Eberron version of this as well. And if you hate it, tell them, don't do this again. I would like an Eberron version of this.
Yeah, that is better.
Yes.
All right, so let's move on. Where are we in the Morning Glory campaign?
So the party had fought their way into the Mornland and then down a tower where they had discovered Kanith Acolytes and then the Shade of Aaron Decanith, who stole Cube from them, fully optimized himself, turned himself into a souped-up Death Knight, and then attacked. They fended off his attacks for 5 rounds, and then he pulsed and exploded, and Bran lost an arm.
Yep.
So prior to that, they had discovered a door that they weren't able to get inside, and there was an inscription on it that just said, "Lest history be repeated." Now, they sort of forgot about that door during the firefight with Aaron DeCanith, but the sphere of annihilation that took Bran's shield also took out
arm, shield arm,
also took out part of the floor and the walls, thus opening up entry into that room.
And so what did we find inside?
There was a portal radiating magic, and when you tried to identify it, you couldn't quite tell what it was, but it did seem sort of akin to teleportation in a way. Now, all of you are thinking, perhaps we should jump into this portal, or perhaps that's a terrible idea. But before that happened,
I made a deal with the devil.
It took you a while to decide to actually do it.
Okay, so put this in perspective of an actual campaign, right? So we ended one session, I lose an arm.
Mm-hmm. And the shield attached to it.
And the shield attached to it. Less concerned about
the
shield.
And the wand that you were holding in it as well.
Yeah, again, you know, things I can live without. Arm, less so. I then had a week to think about, what am I going to do without an arm? And so we were going back and forth and, you know, on our group email trying to figure out what are the options. We weren't too far away. I think we were only two levels away from getting the regenerate spell, mm-hmm. which could regrow my arm. But I'm a little impatient. And so I turned to the bound devil in the chalice that we had been carting around with us ever since we had fought off the vampires
mm-hmm.
back in Stormreach mm-hmm. in Zendrick. Said, hey, Behemoth, I want to make a deal.
And yeah, he made you an offer you couldn't refuse.
Yeah. We signed a contract.
An actual contract.
A physical contract.
Wrote a contract. Yeah. Yeah.
And I had my lawyer review it.
Literally, right. The player, Angelo, who played Bahar, is actually a lawyer.
Right. So I just had him take a quick look, give it the once over. It turns out that writing in fantasy legalese is not really a great... There's not a whole lot of crossover.
I mean, I think that this is an unexplored niche he should look into.
Right, yeah. I mean, there must be DMs everywhere looking to make sure their contracts are ironclad.
Yeah, absolutely. Every time you get a wish.
But, well, yeah, I mean, but that's got to be on-demand consulting services.
It's true. So from a DM's perspective, we were talking over email, and this wasn't happening in session, but Behemoth made you an offer. Hey, do you want to sign a contract? I knew it was coming. I knew I needed to come up with a contract. I am not a lawyer. So I turned to the internet for help.
Ah.
I actually asked Reddit, hey, I'm looking for the text of a contract for a warlock's soul. You know, I made it generic so that people would potentially respond to it and then so that it could be useful to other people as well.
Right.
And I got probably three or four really interesting, really lengthy responses and then kind of cobbled them together into this bit of legalese that suited my purposes.
So what were the main points of that contract?
I'll do you one better. I've got it right here.
Oh, dear.
This contract is made between Bran Talondro, here and after referred to as Damned, and Behemoth, here and after referred to as Familiar. And then it just sort of runs through the actual familiar benefits. You know, you can see through each other's eyes. You can cast spells with ranges of touch.
Communicate telepathically, that sort of thing.
Right. You got his resistance to magic, which was nice. However, in addition, Behemoth also said he would act as your arm. Section 1, subsection D. Familiar shall provide a functional replacement for any and all appendages Damned no longer retains. Such appendages shall function as well or better than Damned's original appendages.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't end up using any more appendages, but I thought just in case.
No, that's a good backup plan. I appreciated that. Build in a contingency.
That's right. Subsection 2, duty of loyalty and best efforts. Familiar shall devote all of his, her, its working time, attention, knowledge, and skills to Damned's interests and shall do with best efforts to the letter of Damned's verbal requests, if not to the spirit of said requests.
Yeah, I think in the actual signed copy, I managed to slip an edit in there that made that a little bit, like, tied you a little bit more to my will.
I think so, yes. And then it lasts forever or until you die or unless there is direct divine intervention. And then all Behemoth really got out of this was that you couldn't prevent him from trying to convince someone else to drink from his cup.
Any beverages proffered by Familiar?
By Familiar, yes.
Yeah, so one of the themes of this, anytime we spoke to Behemoth during the campaign, he always offered a sip of his blood.
Mm.
And so whenever we needed things from him, that was usually the bargain that we made.
I'm going to let all of our listeners in on a little secret. I actually had no idea what drinking Behemoth's blood would do.
I don't think anybody ever did drink his blood. Like, there was an agreement.
There was one time. Oh, yeah. One time Kallak did.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. Because Kallak did not care. But it was only once. And I think it came into play with like one die roll much later.
Ah, okay.
So after Brand has a new arm, which he had to do pretty quickly because many of the other party members said, no, I think that's a bad idea.
So I signed that contract in a hurry.
Once he had a new arm, everyone decided, hey, I guess we'll step through this portal. Maybe that was a bit of railroading on my part. You didn't really have any other options.
It was one of those things where we're like standing around. This is a terrible idea. Nothing good is going to come from going through this portal, but it's the only way forward. So
in you go.
Yeah. Cannonball.
And you ended up in a sewer, a very clean sewer, oddly, underground.
Yep.
And then as you surfaced, Kallak was very confused to see Siren troops.
In what appeared to be pre-Day of Mourning Metrol, the capital of Seer.
So yeah, I did the thing that you really, really shouldn't ever do.
Never do this.
Time travel.
Time travel ruins everything.
It was okay.
It worked out for us, but there's not... spoiler, there's not going to be an episode on how to make time travel work in your campaign.
Because you just shouldn't do it.
Yeah, it's, there's no good advice for that.
Right. Good luck. That I lucked out.
Right.
Yeah.
So we're back in time, and we'll pick up next week. Exactly when in time are we?
Dun, dun, dun. All right. So the three-act structure. This has been around for a long time.
Yeah. It's the basis for lots of seminal works of fiction.
Yeah. It's been around since at least 1977.
Right. Which, of course, is when Star Wars Episode 4 was released.
Right. It's really the first time that the three-act structure was like put into practice.
I don't know if it was the first, but I think it was definitely like the peak.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. The climax.
Something like that. Yeah, so the three-act structure is, of course, a storytelling device, right? It's a way of structuring a narrative so that it has kind of a familiar form. So we're going to talk about this in a way that first, we'll explain the basics of the three-act structure, and then we'll dive into more detail on each of the three acts and how that fits into an RPG campaign. And yes, we're going to use Star Wars as our example, the whole trilogy.
Because it is conveniently divided into three acts, which map very well.
Yes, and we will be talking about episodes 4 through 6, so spoilers.
Those only 1 through 3 don't really exist.
I know. The first act is going to be exposition. That's where you're setting the scene, you're establishing characters, you frame the call to action and the dramatic question. And then generally there's some inciting event that drives the plot forward for the characters.
The second act concerns rising action. This is where the characters try to resolve the inciting event from the first act, but they face challenges. And usually this is where you have character development or character growth as they overcome these challenges or figure out how they're going to overcome them.
Yeah, and they usually have a setback or two.
Or more.
Or lots. And then the third act is the climax and resolution. This is where tension is at its highest and you ultimately answer the dramatic question. So let's talk about this in terms of Star Wars.
In episode 4, we get all of the background about the galaxy far, far away. It opens with a starship battle. So now we know, okay, we're in space.
Right.
And then we very quickly move to this desert planet where there are all kinds of different races.
Yep.
And now we begin to understand, okay, this is weird. This isn't here. In fact, Lucas just opens up the entire thing with just exposition, right?
Mm-hmm.
He just puts his notes on the screen.
Yep. Literally. He gives you that background.
Uh-huh.
And then Luke starts bouncing around the galaxy. We learn that there's a base that has a weapon that can destroy entire planets.
Mm-hmm.
We learn that there's an underground resistance movement to oppose the empire that wields that weapon. We learn that there's this Darth Vader guy who walks around breathing funny and wearing all black. And we also learn that there's magic.
Remember, Star Wars is Luke's story.
Right.
So we're seeing all of this from his perspective. It works really well because he doesn't know any of this stuff. He's a moisture farmer, and we're learning along with him.
Exactly.
And then at the end of the first act, Luke destroys the Death Star in the inciting event that really kicks off the rest of the story, the rise in action when the Empire strikes back.
Right. Literally the name of the next film, right? They strike the base at Hoth and destroy the Rebel plans. They scatter the Rebel forces as they flee in an emergency, and Luke disappears to go off to find Yoda and chase down the Jedi path.
Right. He's looking for ways to overcome the challenges that they're facing.
Exactly.
And of course, the rest of the team
goes to Cloud City.
Right. They run. They look for help, allies.
Yep.
But then it turns out that's just another setback.
Yep. As Han Solo gets frozen in carbonite, Leia gets captured by
Vader.
And then sold off to the Hutts, we learn.
Right. Along with Han. And then Luke rushes into the rescue and fails miserably.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he gets his hand cut off. He learns, oh, crap, my family's terrible.
Yeah, my family is awful. The dude who breathes funny and wears all black is my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And so he jumps down a well and hides for a while.
As you do.
Right. And at the end of episode 5 of The Empire Strikes Back, it looks completely bleak.
Right.
There's almost no hope of them surviving, of them achieving their goal of overthrowing the Empire.
However,
we kick off the third act, the climax and resolution, Return of the Jedi. Literally, Luke comes back into the fold, and now he has mastered magic.
We didn't even necessarily need to see that happen on screen, but the previous two acts have set it up so that we know that that is going to happen, that that is necessary. And so it is believable when it does happen.
Right, right. And he shows up like a total badass at Jabba's palace and starts springing his friends. He kills the Rancor. He somehow convinces Lando to join him and bailing out his old buddy Han.
Han bumbles around, takes out Boba Fett.
Yep. Sarlacc gets a good meal for a day.
1,000 years. For 1,000 years.
And then, yeah, and then we progress along. We learn of the second Death Star, which is under construction. We learn of sort of the rising stakes of that, because if the second Death Star is completed, the rebellion will have no chance of succeeding. And so the stage is set for the final conflict of Luke and Vader and the Emperor, along with the starship battle to actually destroy the Death Star, and then the small strike team on Endor's moon.
Right. At this point, there aren't any questions about where the story is going to go or what the characters need to do. They know what they need to get in order to win. They know where they need to go. They know where they need to be. They know who they need to defeat. They just have to do it.
Yeah. And as the viewer, you know that if any one of these things fails, there's going to be terrible consequences for one of those characters. If the shields don't go down, the attack on the Death Star can't succeed. If the attack on the Death Star doesn't work, it won't matter if the shields go down. And either way, if the Death Star is destroyed with Luke on board, it's a disaster.
Mm-hmm. If Luke turns to the dark side, gives into his anger, it doesn't really matter what happens on the moon. He is going to rule the galaxy with his father.
Yeah. So that's the dramatic question. The tension is its highest, and then we get our answer, right? The Emperor is killed when Vader turns on him. Luke evacuates. The shields go down on the moon, and ultimately, the Death Star is destroyed.
And then nothing happens for 30 years.
Oh, they retconned it. It's the most powerful tool in the DM's toolkit. So we've talked about one iconic example of the three-act structure, but let's kind of break it down for how it works in games.
Well, it works differently in different kinds of games. So we're going to cover dungeon crawls, intrigue and mystery games, and long-term campaigns.
Yeah, so let's talk about the first act, the exposition.
It's pretty similar for most types of games, right? This is where you need to give your players the essential information or misinformation. You know, where are they? What's happening in the world? What's the history of this place? What are the characters' backstories? And where do your PCs fit into this story that's already moving along?
Yeah, and if you're talking about like a dungeon crawl, these will be very basic answers. You'll be looking at things like, why would my PC pick up a sword and go adventuring? Or who are the people giving us the information that we're going to chase down, you know? And what's the MacGuffin that we're after? Because face it, a dungeon crawl is usually a MacGuffin-based adventure.
Yeah, or the dungeon itself is the antagonist.
Right.
But in an intrigue game, the exposition is much more important. The inciting incident that happens in the first act often appears early. You know, there's a murder to investigate. You need to find spies. The PCs might be a part of that. They might only be witnesses. But in either case, it's important to invest them in some way in that outcome. You can see this in a common trope where the PCs are accused of the crime.
Right, right.
And of course, they'll investigate, but the situation gets worse.
Either they're in over their heads, they uncover a conspiracy, or they realize the culprit is somebody too powerful for them to oppose or expose.
Right, or perhaps there will be terrible repercussions for the nation if they find out that the prince is the one who killed his father.
Right.
Whatever's going on, there's some complication that prevents them from completing this mystery.
All right, and then for a long-term campaign.
Exposition is everything. Honestly, I feel if you're going to have someone play in a world that you've created for years, you need to take the time to really make it a living, breathing world. You need to have a history. The player backstories need to fit in. And the first few adventures usually don't have that much at stake, but they're really great for adding in those plot elements that will become important later on. And then, of course, you need some sort of dramatic event that has the party realize, oh, wait, there is something larger at stake here. You know, and it answers that question is why does this story revolve around these people?
Yeah, why have we gone from raiding ancient dungeons and, you know, recollecting artifacts to now getting involved in the politics of nations or the schemes of fiends or the machinations of angels?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not that latter one.
I mean, the first act for a long-term campaign is a great time to get a lot of feedback from your players and figure out where it is they want the story to go.
Right, right. So how about the second act? This is rising action.
When you're talking about an RPG, this time is usually very player-directed. The course of action is determined by your character's motivations, which should have been firmly established in that first act, but they might be tested here. It doesn't necessarily mean that what is written on the sheet is what they're going to stick to.
Yeah, this is a lot of times in the second act where you run into problems in your campaign because players aren't using the motivations they originally signed up for.
And that's fine as long as that's explained in game. You know, why is it that suddenly your noble paladin has become very greedy or vice versa?
Right.
And perhaps it is because of that inciting event that happened in the first act. There is something larger at play.
Sure.
In RPGs, though, it's important to include victories here in this second act, right? We talk about there are a lot of setbacks. And in a movie like The Empire Strikes Back, you can just hit the characters over and over again with horrible things that are happening. But when you're playing a PC, it gets really boring week after week just to fail over and over again.
Yeah, the thing about failing forward is that it's still not the fun way to go forward. Sometimes it's fun to just win once in a while, right?
Right.
So make sure the players have an opportunity.
So in a dungeon crawl, the rising action is really just getting them to use up their resources. You know, they get injured, they get separated, their gear gets destroyed, they get lost.
Right. You maybe lose an arm in the dungeon.
That happens a lot. It's pretty normal.
Yeah. But you have character growth as well. I mean, this is where you level up. You find more loot. You befriend a companion in the dungeon who knows secrets or something.
Right. But eventually they'll confront a challenge that they just can't handle. And that's a potential TPK in a traditional dungeon crawl.
Yeah. And this is one of the challenges of RPGs as a medium is you're never guaranteed to get that conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
So every time you put the players at risk, you have to have some idea in your head of how does this become the end of the story? Or is it the end of the story?
In an intrigue game, the PCs at this point are determining how they're going to resolve the complication from the first act. This is where investigations tend to really go off the rails because the players are having so many ideas. There's so many different paths that they could take to actually figure this situation out. So they tend to head in too many directions, or given all of the evidence, things get too confusing to actually get a clear picture.
Yeah, this is where you've plotted your relationship map. You've figured out your conspiracy, your web of lies, and the PCs are trying to pull at threads to see what falls out. But this is the challenge. They can't see enough to understand what they're looking at yet.
It's also a big challenge for GMs because you'd never necessarily know what it is that your players are going to tug at each session.
Right.
And what needs to fall out in order to make sense in this larger web as it becomes more uncovered, but not expose the entire story all at once.
Yeah, because you've probably got some type of big reveal, right? You've got some moment that you're hiding from the players, right? Some information that will make them go, oh man, that's awesome. If that becomes too apparent because they're getting too much information, then that loses its power. But if that becomes too hard, they may never get there.
Right. So you need to keep your antagonists one step ahead. And then I think one thing that I like to do is as these PCs uncover the truth, they'll realize that somehow they've become entangled in it themselves.
Yeah, you never want them to feel like they can walk away from the intrigue. Even if they don't know who they're opposing, they should know that they're identified. They're not going to be allowed to walk away.
Right. And again, the thing that's going to keep them involved in this is those motivations and those relationships that they've developed in the first act.
Exactly.
In a long-term campaign, this is where PCs are figuring out their long-term motivations. And then you use that motivation to send them in a direction. Either they are pursuing the MacGuffins to destroy the BBEG, or they're being pursued, maybe both.
Yeah, this is the part where there's five pieces of the artifact that they need to collect in order to reforge the ancient sword that can kill the demon. And each of those artifacts they have to track down and then fight whatever's possessing it or guarding it. Each of those is a challenge that could have severe consequences for them.
The reason that this kind of structure is often used in long campaigns is that when you're playing for a very long period of time, victory needs to come more often than defeat in order for it to be interesting. And, you know, being able to gather all those pieces or all those things that you need in order to actually accomplish the goal gives you concrete progress that players and the characters can feel good about.
Yeah, that's, you know, MacGuffins get mocked a little bit, but in games, a lot of times a MacGuffin or a collection of MacGuffins can provide a scoreboard. You know that you're 60% of the way there because you've collected 3 out of the 5 artifacts.
Of course, remember that during this act, your PCs are also supposed to suffer these setbacks. So while they're winning in one place, they can be losing somewhere else. The enemies are moving behind the scenes. Your PCs decide, okay, we're going to go to the volcano. Well, that means the cultists in the jungle summon their demon.
Right. They're more powerful when they get there because you didn't deal with them first. And right. that's how you explain within the story that it's more difficult each one you get. The first one was always the easiest.
Why is the DC to open this door harder than at level 5? Well, they made the door stronger.
Yeah, because they had some time to work it out.
Right. So when dealing with these setbacks, each character needs to decide what does winning mean for them? What is it that they're going to be willing to give up, and what is it that they have to have in order to feel like they accomplished what their character goals are? This is where you get the character arc, you get the character growth. They're deciding, okay, I was a paladin, and now I've seen that, you know, the tenets of my church didn't see me through all of these setbacks, and now maybe I'm switching gods or switching classes or something like that.
Yeah, and this is where you want to be open with your players too. You don't want to lock your players into choices that they've made, because this is the opportunity for growth. They've been in the shoes of that character, right? Let them explore where that character can go.
Right. I would go so far as to say that there should be some kind of change in the motivation of the character.
Yeah, I went from rogue 15 to rogue 17. That's a change.
And now I have a better sword.
The numbers on my sheet got higher, Ishan. It's a change.
Good RP.
How about the third act, the climax or resolution?
Well, in a dungeon crawl, this is usually pretty quick. We kick open the door to the final room, and we kill the Tarrasque, or it eats us.
Or Tiamat, or
whatever.
Know, whatever.
Yeah. You've already got the tools or the abilities or the secrets of the dungeon that you need to defeat this. It's really just a question of, are the dice going to be in your favor?
Sure. Or have you planned appropriately or finished preparations appropriately, that sort of thing.
Right.
And then in an intrigue campaign, this is where the PCs have to figure it out, right? This is where they have all the information they need and they decide, okay, so if the assassin was from this noble house, then I have to rally the other 7 noble houses against them using this evidence so that we can overturn or overthrow them.
And if you're running this game the right kind of way, this will involve tough decisions for them. They might have to sacrifice on their part, or They might have sacrificed some innocents, valuable NPCs. You know, maybe they discovered that the assassin is one of their friends.
That's always the best.
Right. So what do they do? Do they do what's legally right and turn them in and have them executed? Do they let them go, but now the case is unsolved?
Yeah, you have to let them determine what does winning look like? Because an intrigue campaign or an intrigue game is always going to be more complicated. It's not going to be as cut and dry of, well, we survived and we got the shiny thing.
Right, you can't have everything.
Exactly.
And then those sacrifices are going to help you determine what each character's arc is going to be, the thing that they choose and the thing that they choose to give up.
And then in a long-term campaign, the conclusion of this is the payoff for months or years of effort, right?
Right. So each session at this point needs to include some sort of concrete progress. Something needs to happen where the story comes together, or you obtain a MacGuffin, or you obtain information that you need to overcome a challenge, which is likely happening in the next session.
Right. So you need clear direction on where you're going, and you need to know who the enemy is at this point.
Right. Just like in Return of the Jedi.
Right. And there can be a twist, but you still need to be within the bounds of you have more information than unknowns.
Right. In a long-term campaign, you don't need to stretch out the three acts to an entire campaign that lasts, you know, multiple years. You can string the three acts together. So when you're coming to the climax, the payoff either needs to be a satisfying end to the story if the campaign's over, or it raises the stakes and then draws the story into that next arc. So there's a climax, there's a confrontation with an enemy. The players, perhaps they win, but then they find out, oh, guess what? That wasn't the final enemy. Their strings were being pulled by something else. Move into the next arc, exposition.
Right. Or, you know, we solve the problem in the kingdom, but the kingdom still has problems with the other municipalities on this continent, right? And once this continent is at peace, maybe there's extraplanar beings that are threatening the whole world.
Right. If this sounds sort of tropey, it's because it works really well.
Yeah, they're tropes for a reason. It's not cliche. It's great. And you can keep spinning these arcs around as long as you need to. You know, I mean, when you hear stories of campaigns that have gone 5-10 years, it's because they're using this arc method of there's a period of character growth. There's a challenge and then there's a conclusion, right? And then there's a new challenge and a period of growth and a conclusion.
Just keep repeating it as necessary.
You know, or, you know, until you run out of ideas.
Well, then you just do prequels.
Oh, smart. Flashbacks. Do you hear that, Ishin?
Is it the sound of more money falling into George Lucas's pockets?
Well, yes, but it's also time to move on to the Character Creation Forge. Before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
Or you can tweet at Ishin at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
If you can't fit it into 140 characters, you can also email us at totalpartythrill@gmail.com.
And lastly, you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com.
So this week's Character Creation Forge is the strength-based monk. This was inspired by our Grappler Redux. We had considered this as a possible build for the Grappler, and then I had also seen on some forums people were asking, hey, is it possible to build a monk that's based on strength? Well, the answer is, yeah.
Sort of, kind of. Yeah.
Really, you've got AC issues, and that's the thing that you need to mitigate the entire time.
Right.
But the build that we came up with is really a crit fisher. This version is a lot heavier on monk flavor than the second Grappler that we built.
Right, so let's explain what crit fishing is.
Fishing for critical hits.
Yeah, so what you're trying to do is maximize the dice that you roll and the numbers that will give you crits on those dice. So that means making as many attacks as possible, making as many attacks with advantage as possible, and then if you can, also increasing the range of critical hits, which currently there's one way to do that, and that's using the champion fighter.
Right. So this build pumps out multiple attacks with advantage and crits on a 19 or 20. So each round, it makes 8 attack rolls, which gives a 57% chance of one crit per round. And if you use Action Surge, you're up to 81%. But it does have those AC issues.
Yeah. And so, you know, a crit is a pr- pretty straightforward thing, right? You take every die you roll and you roll it again. You add them together. So it also helps to have ways to add lots of dice to make your crits really big.
Which is why we decided to go half-orc.
Because half-orc has a wonderful racial feature.
When you crit, you do an extra die of damage. So the level spread is Monk 14, Barbarian 3, Fighter 3. Start with a half-orc because it's got great stats for that. Plus 2 to strength, plus 1 to con. And Relentless Endurance, which means once per day, when you would drop to 0, you don't. You instead drop to 1, which is going to be really helpful at low levels because, like we said, terrible AC.
Yeah.
You can also go dwarf. It's a good option if you're more defensively minded. Helps your con a little bit. But your stat spread is high strength, high wisdom.
All right. So what's the order of advancement? At level 1, we're going to start monk.
Yeah. And you start monk because this is a monk character. You want to be monkey the entire time. So remember, when we're telling you what level to do, we're picking 1 through 20, the one that is most effective because we expect that you'll be playing this all the way through. So you get unarmored defense, which means you'll get your wisdom bonus to AC, and then you've got a bonus action attack. For a bonus action, you make 1 unarmed attack. So you're already at level 1 making 2 attacks per round. At level 2, you're going to hop into Barbarian. That gives you your rage, which is going to help a lot because you are having the physical damage that you're taking. You get a nice little damage bonus.
Mm-hmm. Plus 2 damage per attack.
Right. And then after that, the next 4 levels, you're going to take Monk to 5. The main reason for that is to get extra attack, at which point you'll be doing 2 attacks and then 2 flurries, so 4 attacks per round. You get the Monk goodies, the speed boost. You're going to take Open Hand, which lets you provoke a dex saving throw to knock your opponent prone. And of course, once they're prone, that grants advantage. So now you're, of course, rolling twice. You get an ability score increase. And at Monk level 5, you get Stunning Strike, which you pop a key point, and if they fail their saving throw, they're going to be stunned, which will grant advantage not just to you, but to your entire party.
Yeah, and this versatility and getting advantage on your attacks is the reason that we don't look for an ability like Reckless Attack from the Barbarian at level 2.
Right, you'll get it later, but you don't need it right now.
Right.
Then level 7 to 9, you take 3 levels of Fighter. You get a Fighting Style. Dueling's pretty good. It helps your AC a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You get Action Surge, which is great for maximizing those crits. And then, of course, at level 3, Champion for an expanded crit range. Doubles your chances of a crit.
Yeah, now you crit on a 19.
And you're making 4 attacks a round, so 8 attack rolls per round. 16 attack rolls if you Action Surge.
Yeah.
After that, you can basically take Monk or Barbarian in any order. You just want to balance getting to level 3, the Bear Totem, which gives, when you're raging, you get resistance to all damage except for psychic, versus getting more key points that you can use for Flurry and Open Hand and Stunning Strike. And then, of course, at Barb 2, you get Reckless Attack.
Yeah.
It's a nice, cheap way to get advantage, but if you don't have to use it, I recommend not. It may be later in a combat if you're running low on key points, you can go ahead and use that and save your key points for something like Stunning Strike.
Yeah, I mean, Reckless Attack is a very risky move if you're not raging.
Yes.
Because you want the damage resistance from rage before you Reckless Attack. And fortunately, it's far enough along that, you know, you'll have a decent HP total as well.
Right, exactly. For options, you could drop a little bit of Monk and take Barbarian to 6 if you wanted 4 rages per day and you want to get a Tiger Totem for more skills. The other option you can do is take Barbarian to 4 and Fighter to 4 because that gets you 2 more ability score increases, which this character lives off stats. Don't take feats, just take ability score increases.
Yeah, and that means from magic items, anything that will boost your stats, is especially your AC, is going to be really helpful. So those Belts of Giant Strength.
Yeah, sadly, the boots that increase your dex to 19 are always going to be helpful. It'll just give you plus 4 to AC.
Yeah, and your Amulet of Health to increase your con.
Your con, which is also great, which will also increase your AC.
AC, yeah.
And then Periaptive Wisdom, you can't use them. You can use them, but you can't benefit from them both at the same time.
Right.
But in any case, I hate suggesting those items, but they'll give you plus 8 to AC.
Right, right. Okay, so character arc time. How does your monk barbarian come upon this path?
I think there are many different types of monk traditions. We talked about before how a monk doesn't necessarily need to fit this Eastern flavor, right? Meditating. I think a monk tradition created by orcs would be focused on brutal, quick, efficient combat. So that means hitting your enemy as many times as you can and hitting them where it hurts. So I would think of it kind of like Klingon martial arts, right? If I was going to stat Worf, I would stat him as a barbarian who has a lot of training with martial arts, you know, monk levels, because he uses his rage and his fury and channels it into his warrior path, which is a combination of unbridled fury, the discipline of the fighter, and the ability to maintain just enough control to hit where it hurts that you get from monk.
Yeah, so you know that I can't check you on the Star Trek.
That's correct.
But I like that idea for a character. I would actually throw out the monk flavor entirely. So I would look at it as a set of abilities and kind of build each of those separately. And I would build it as the unrelenting brute, if you will. The, you know, he is the guy who's got two fists and he's not afraid to use them. He will walk up to you and punch you square in the chest. And
throw you 15 feet.
Yeah. You know, when you think of, he's basically a player monster, if you will, right? If you think of how you typically react to orcs as monsters, this is kind of the playable orc monster. He doesn't need weapons. He's just going to beat you. And so all of his sort of decisions, all of his training, all of his thought process goes into making his hands better weapons. So if that means channeling rage, then he is going to learn to channel his rage. If that means learning the soft points of his targets to get better critical hits, that's what he's going to learn how to do. And at every turn, he's going to take something to make himself better. And so I would probably go for the option with a few more levels of barbarian.
I like how when you break classes down into their constituent parts, they're really easy to reflavor. It's one thing I like about 5e. Even if you went monk all the way to 14, you look at something like Tranquility. Flavor-wise, it doesn't fit with your character, but
not at all.
But enemies needing to make wisdom saving throws before they can actually
definitely
attack him.
Definitely fits my character. Yeah, it's you suddenly feel Tranquility because attacking me seems like a terrible idea. It's like, let the Wookiee win.
All right, so is this a character you would play?
I think I would play it for a short game. Yeah, I don't know that I'd want to carry sort of a one-note character through a long campaign, but I think for like a one-shot or like a con game, I think it'd be a blast.
I would play this character partially because of its weakness. It's got low AC, and it is hard to mitigate that low AC, so you actually need to be kind of careful. You're playing this character that rushes into melee and needs to stay in melee and gets hit a lot, but you got to keep an eye on those HP. You have ways to regain those HP, but there's resource management with this character, and that's something that I think is sometimes missing in 5e characters. It's hard for them to die.
Yeah, and if you like resource management, that's great. So choose accordingly.
Right, but if you don't, I probably wouldn't play this character.
This is a way more complicated version of a martial character than you need.
Yeah.
You know? All right, as we're wrapping up here, if you'd like to support the show, the easiest way to do that is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And if you're willing to help us out, we'll read your 5-star review on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher. It's like a Pandora for podcasts. If you like us there, the algorithm will help other people find us.
Yeah, and I learned there's actually 5-star reviews on Stitcher as well. So
we should go look there for them.
We have one.
Oh.
We'll read it next week.
Perfect. But we've got another 5-star review.
Yes, from iTunes.
This is Thrilling Knowledge Dumping by The Scando. The two hosts do a good job of telling a story of their campaign and delving deep into things that happened and how that changed the game and what they learned from it. The stuff that they have done with the grappler is probably the greatest thing ever recorded, mainly because Mundangerous is finally coming around to it. Totally worth listening to for the knowledge that they drop. I'm glad we're finally selling you on the grappler.
Yeah, I am coming around to it, slowly but surely. But thanks. That's from Petter, who's a friend of the show. He's one of the guys behind Nerdologist.com, and he also hosts, or he DMs for the Dungeons & Flagons actual play podcast. So check him out. What do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about investigation adventures.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building a Jedi.
Wow.
You're welcome.
We're going to get a takedown notice from Disney for that.
We're building a space monk with a laser sword.
Well, on that IP appropriate note, that's it for episode 19 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.